Good afternoon from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. This is Valley Roundup. Today, we look back at the stories that defined 2018 here in the Valley. I'm in the studio with Curtis Wackerly and David Krause, the editors of the Aspen Daily News and Aspen Times, respectively. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Allison.
Thanks so much for coming in today. We also have John Masters, executive director of Grassroots TV. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Allison.
Join us. Let's take a look back. Well, for 2018, I don't think there's another story that's as big as the Lake Christine fire, both in the magnitude, the number of people it affected, and the length that that story carried on. So we're definitely going to start with the Lake Christine fire. Dave, you said that that's of your top 20 stories of people engaging on the website, that's like half of the stories had to do with Lake Christine.
Yeah, by far that was the most read overall story. Like you said, it continued on into October.
Yeah.
So, there were hundreds of stories put out there, videos, photos, from the community, from the actual live breaking news of it to the follow through, to the court hearings. That'll go on into 2019. The two suspects, I believe, have a January court date over in Vail at the Eagle County building over there. So, by far, engaged the whole valley, anybody coming in, anybody who lived here. So for sure, hopefully we don't have another one like that, a big story that big for a long, long time.
I think of it as like a mid-century, like Americana play. It started, it hit on the 4th of July weekend. It's our busiest weekend. It's families playing around, there's parades and there's blankets. Like, you could not have staged that better. Curtis, how much do you think that the fact that we were at full capacity, that there was visitors, that there was flights coming in and out, had to do with the magnitude of all that?
That definitely added a lot to it. As you said, it caused so many more people to be there and to be impacted and to see it up close. And I mean, I think it was just such a terrifying experience, really. No one will ever forget being there, especially those first couple days and seeing, seeing the whole side of the valley on fire. I mean, I remember I was driving home from Carbondale on the 4th of July, and oh boy. And I think that's part of it, too. You mentioned the video and the pictures,
it's such a visual story.
Yeah, it really was. And
yeah, I was doing some number looks couple weeks ago just on our video stuff, and in the first 5 days of that fire we posted 11 videos between our Facebook Live projects and press conferences, the news briefing when the governor and the senators and the state reps were here, and then just the like you said, it was such a visual event, and wildfires unfortunately are that way. They kind of just make you stop and stand in awe of, just the power that they have. So I was surprised how well those, 11 videos did, over 100,000 views, which for us was, if we get 2,000 or 3,000 views on a particular video, that's great for us. I think the community meetings were important. Mm-hmm. We all worked and had people at those community meetings trying to get that news out quickly, either by Facebook Live, by, tweeting, because people were just so starved for information. And the third, when it didn't seem like it was going to be that big,
right,
and then the evening of the fourth, like Curtis mm-hmm. said, and it just
kept
exploded.
Remember, it died down for a little bit, and right, people kind of thought, oh, maybe this is, this is starting to be over. And then it blew right back up and was with us for another, 3 weeks, I feel like, or it was in the news almost every day.
Yeah, it was. And once they brought all the feds in and mm-hmm. the 500-600 firefighters who came in, within the first 5 days of that thing, it was just crazy how the Mid-Valley mm-hmm. just exploded with firefighters, with smoke, and, how it disrupted a lot of things from the airport. Like
yeah.
you mentioned, people coming in and out to bookings and just kind of disruption. The fear that we were going to lose power for 3 days, a lot of people, kind of lost track of that. They lost 4 out of those 6 power lines that come up Valley, and mm-hmm. had they lost those other 2, there was that pick and alert out about
be
ready for up to 3 mm-hmm. days without power in the Upper Valley.
But there was a lot of coordination there. That was an impressive part of it, to see the response for all hands on deck, every agency, the Valley and a lot of the Western Slope, the whole federal government was working on our behalf. So,
yeah. And of course, it's such a increasingly common national story, right? California is still being hit so hard with really devastating fires. So there's more of that understanding these days. I think like more and more people have experienced that. Though that visual, yeah, of course, a fire is always visual, but we had that visual of literally a receding line into a town because that's what it is in this valley. We live here because we're a budding national forest. You know, we have all this open space around us.
I also think that most news stories are in a way academic. You know, they're interesting or they're entertaining or they have some, you might think they have some sort of influence in your life, but this was drama. This is the evil fire and the good guys fighting that fire. Mm-hmm. And it affected so many people so closely, and it was so dangerous. It did go right into the town, and we could have had a Paradise, California scene there. Mm-hmm. And everyone kind of standing back and hoping that the heroes, and what was interesting was that early on, it was just a handful of local firefighters that were dealing with it. And that made it so tactile and tangible to everyone.
Yeah.
For as devastating of a story it is, I do think that at the end, looking back now, the plot, like the end chapter there is that everything worked out. I mean, we had, I think, 3 homes lost total.
Yep.
No loss of life. All these agencies came together. You know, we had places for people to stay. We had places for pets. We had people bringing in meals. I mean, it was this kind of, okay, we're okay.
But it makes you feel lucky, frankly. Like, the vulnerability that you felt doesn't go away after you go through something like that, I think.
Yeah, and I think the image that I just keep thinking about a lot, I think it was the Denver News Station sent over their helicopter and they had that aerial photo of how close it really got to the mobile home park, literally across the other side of the fence and melting some of those outer buildings. And the video, I think it was the Dillon Fire Department or you know, that crew that came over standing on the porch, you know, of some of those houses spraying down from the porch at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, because that was going on. Yeah, yeah. From the night of the 4th, like Curtis mentioned earlier, you know, they were almost gearing down around 9, 10 o'clock saying, okay, I think it's going to settle down for the night. And then we got that unusual down valley wind and it just blew it up and over. And then, you know, right toward Ace's property and then, you know, toward the mobile home park and then toward Missouri Heights. And, you know, I've told this story. I was standing in the parking lot at 3 o'clock in the morning by the movie theater just watching that fire because you just could not look at it. And there were hundreds of people in that parking lot at City Market and the Park and Ride and the Whole Foods. Those parking lots were filled at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning with people who had all evacuated, you know, 500 homes or whatever in that area. And they didn't, at that point, it was so disjointed, they just didn't know where to go. So everybody just hung out in the parking lot and kind of watched a fire.
I still have goosebumps thinking about that. Another unique thing about this fire is that we know how it started and we know the people who started it. Intentionality is not there and that there's still a trial going on, but it started at the Basalt gun range using something you're not allowed to use at the gun range in a fire restriction. And so that's the one part that's going to linger into the next year as we talk about this story is, first of all, the trial, and second of all, that gun range is open.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the part that was tough. There's a lot of debate about the gun range and whether it should have been closed because it was, I mean, an epically dry drought. We were under fire restrictions since, you know, May, something like that, in the springtime. And, you know, it sort of kicked off this debate that feels kind of Old West versus New West a little bit. And the growth of the town and, you know, should that gun range be closed? And, of course, it didn't happen, but...
I think the safety procedures that they put into place will help, but I think it's an ongoing debate about what's going to happen with that gun range because we do need them.
And the fact is it was being operated in an extremely unsafe manner by people who should have known better. Mm-hmm. You know, most people will go and use it safely and there's no problem. It had been used every day, you know, for weeks and weeks of dry weather and there wasn't a problem until someone did something you shouldn't have.
Well, and for decades.
Right.
You know, right. And it's amazing that didn't happen before. Mm-hmm. And it really took somebody who was particularly irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
with the wrong, using tracer bullets, and obviously clearly missing the target by a wide margin, and it shooting up into the hill. I lived in Old Town Basalt for quite a while in the 90s, and it was always a little odd because you can always hear the gun range, you know, and it's just a little odd that there was a gun range that close to the town, and gun ranges are really important, particularly in Colorado, but and it's a great place for people to learn responsibility. For gun owners to pass that on to the next generation, and it's a place where you're surrounded by responsible gun owners and gun users, and so it's a really great idea. It's a little odd. It's that close.
Well, and it was important to get it back open at that particular time because people needed to start getting rifles sighted for hunting season, and you don't want them going out into the general forest area. And that's the biggest part of the debate, right, is you disperse them out into the forest and you get issues like they have over by Colorado Springs where, 4 or 5 years ago, there was a grandfather who was shot by a stray bullet sitting around a campfire and killed. Mm-hmm. So there, you just don't want that scenario to happen. So I think the area and the people understand the importance of gun ranges. It's just, to John's point, is that in the right spot? Will we see it get moved? And more importantly, is who's paying for that?
Right, it's kind of locked in place now. You can't just go buy a bunch of land and open a gun range anywhere in the valley.
Right.
And I'm not following the legal proceedings as much, but no one's thinking that this couple, and I don't know if we know which of the two, I think the shot the tracer that started the fire. No one thinks that they went out to start a fire, right? So what could they get in trouble for? Just misuse of firearms?
The carelessness, and now that there were three homes burned and the value of those homes are the issue. Because the couple said that day what they did, so that's like to your point earlier, that's not up for debate, right?
It's severity. It's not an investigation.
Right. They both fully admitted, that day after initially denying it, they did own up to it. And so I think that's, that's where the value of the homes, luckily it wasn't more. Luckily no one got seriously hurt. We had a couple firefighters get hurt through the process. They had the bulldozer that rolled over, but nothing. Luckily, when you have 600 people, here fighting a fire at one time, the coordination effort, it just shows you the coordination efforts and the value they put on safety for the firefighters, that nobody was more severely hurt than that.
All right, before we go to break, again, you're listening to our year-end show on Valley Roundup and the Lake Christine fire. In my mind, no doubt, the biggest story that affected us here locally. So another story that took up more than 1 month of reporting, and I would say maybe around 3 to 10 years overall of reporting, is the fact that the school board did not re-up the superintendent's contract, John Malloy. And this is after nearly a decade of lots of community members, parents, teachers saying that, pointing the finger at him about the culture at the Aspen School District. So the Aspen Times had a lot to do with breaking this story. I think the revelation that the HR director at the schools has some legal trouble is actually kind of the last straw on the Malloy issue.
Yeah, I think that's, you saw the Parent Action Committee form after that information came out. That came to us in July in an anonymous letter that the superintendent got as well, that said that Elizabeth Hodges had been disbarred as a lawyer in Missouri. We went from there and spent a few weeks digging into her background a little bit more just to see how that started, and found that she was charged and settled on a misdemeanor charge of false business practices as a lawyer representing a deceased couple, stemming from her allegedly selling a vehicle, not reporting that as part of the estate sale. Then the family got involved. She didn't challenge the disbarment. To her point, in our reporting, she told us she wasn't going to be a lawyer anymore, that it was going to cost $20,000 to $30,000. She wasn't going to live in Missouri anymore. Okay. So that's why she didn't challenge that. The question became that what upset a lot of people was that the HR director, who's responsible for nearly 300 people and their backgrounds and all that, never told her bosses any of this was going on. And so once we found some of these court documents and more information there. And now, you know, that judgment was less than $1 million, but with interest now, it's about $1.1 million. Wow. You know, at what point does the HR director tell the superintendent, hey, just so you know, I have some trouble going on in my background? And that never came to light. So I think that is what frustrated most parents to start the action committee. You guys would know better than I, you know, the history, the issues that some teachers, you know, there are a lot of teachers who really like working with John Malloy and, you know, don't have an issue with his style or anything. But there are other people who have butted heads, you know, just like you have with any relationship between a superintendent or a boss and an employee. You know, sometimes not everybody gets along, especially when you talk about hundreds of people. So, but I think that was the part where the parents finally said, you know, we just don't feel like this is going in the right direction. And the push became that. And then it became a 3-2 vote on the school board not to renew his contract, which is on a rolling 3-year bid. So, and then, of course, they're bringing in the third party group to look at climate and culture and see how that looks. We were met with a couple school board members yesterday about what that looks like. I think they're on a very smart and aggressive timeline at the first of the year to get this third party in to talk to, you know, staff first, the school board, and then all the principals, and then the individual people. And they have a really, Dwayne Romero and Susan Maralt, the president, now vice presidents of the school board, have a pretty aggressive timeline to really see what they can do with this climate and culture report once they get it.
That I do think that there has been some puzzle pieces being laid down over the course of the years. For that to be a 3-2 vote on the school board, we had to have a school board election 2 falls ago, right? In order to even set that up, because John Malloy had such strong support from the current board. And it sounds like the Susie Zimmet is maybe the change enough that was that allowed that to happen. At the same time, we had the Elizabeth Hodges revelation, and so it kind of all fell into place. I don't know, John, how much you've paid attention to the school district, that they have turnover constantly, right? And so I think it is easy if you're working there, you probably like it enough that you'll say good things. I think what happens is when you start talking to the people who don't work there anymore, and when you talk to, and that's 18 people a year, you know, that starts to build up.
Well, it's difficult to live in the big mountains, you know, and especially as a teacher or as a school administrator. I think when you see that there's a job opening in Aspen, Colorado, and with this great school district, and it's small, and it's it's like a dream job, and you get here, and you know, life's not as easy as you thought it was going to be. And I know from talking with coaches and teachers here that parents in Aspen have extremely high expectations and demands that I don't think you find in most communities. And so they demand excellence, which is great, you know, and we should do that. But you also need to realize you're working with human beings, and I think there's a lot of stress. I just think there's a lot of stress in the school district that isn't necessarily, may not be the supervisor's responsibility necessarily all the time. And but I also really admire the people on the school board for volunteering to do this,
right,
and take and try to wrestle with this, and it seems to me they're doing a really great job. And I think they got some flack for why you're spending money doing, you know, bringing in an outside group to do this. And I think politically that's a really smart move. And it is their job, the school board's job, to come up with a solution. Really, they don't necessarily need to be the judge all the way through. So let somebody else who's done this before take a look at it and create a report, and then you can make a judgment from there.
We all get to see that, right? Is that?
Yes. Yeah.
It'll be released to the public. I'm very curious to see what it will say. I mean, there's a long history here, as has been noted. You know, we went through some years of lots of turnover between teachers. And, you know, there were three principals at the high school in the span of a couple of years. You know, I think we went through a period where teachers didn't get raises for a long time. You know, there was the budget was growing, but it wasn't. So and it's a tricky place in any situation. It seems like schools are people are very intense with the way things should be run.
But having a high schooler on the one of the four of us on the panel, having somebody in the high school who was at a bigger high school in Denver, I can honestly 100% say that the value of the teachers here, not that all teachers aren't this way, but the value and the engagement of the teachers at this school and this school district, I continue to be impressed with. And there is, you know, that engagement. You look at the AEF Foundation and what they've been able to do, because there are people here who want to help support, you know, the school district.
That's excellent. And I think John might respond that AEF, I mean, it's hard when that much of your funding comes essentially privately and it's a public institution. How beholden are you to those parents who are giving that kind of money? And so that it is a very unique, very complicated place. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you guys think. I can't help but wonder if Malloy looks back and thinks, had I handled the Hodges thing differently or sooner, my reputation might not have also been questioned, because the revelations came out that she had this disbarment, and the immediate reaction from the school and the school board was, oh, well, you know, we're going to keep her. They didn't put her on administrative leave. You know, they were we're behind her. And if that had been handled slightly differently, do you think would things have changed for him?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, some of the history here, the decade of frustration, maybe not. It was interesting how they, you know, didn't try to get out ahead of it a little bit more than they did, you know, when we talked to them initially, I think. But they were, you know, I think they were kind of surprised. But at the same time, they're trying to stand behind their employee, especially at the beginning, because they didn't really know a lot of this. You know, we dug it up over the course of three, almost 4 weeks.
Okay.
You know, we developed that a little bit more than just, oh, here's an anonymous letter. And it was, you know, I think they were shocked as well. But the school board came out in, you know, one unison saying we're still behind our employee, as did the superintendent. And I think to that point, that's where people said, okay, at what point, to your point, when do we put this employee on paid administrative leave or some kind of leave and at least help settle down inside the buildings what was going on? Because this all started, you know, in July and August before school opened.
Right.
And then you open the school year with that, you know, on the chalkboard, so to speak. And I think, you know, that just, it didn't help the idea and the process.
It seems like you would want to do that first and immediately do your own investigation. And they also probably felt spurned, you know, to David's point. She didn't disclose this. They had to find out, you know, through these other means, and probably didn't feel good.
All right, you are listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. This week, I'm joined by John Masters, Executive Director of Grassroots TV, David Krause, Editor of the Aspen Times, and Curtis Wackerly, Editor of the Aspen Daily News. We're looking back at the stories that defined 2018. Stay with us. When Aspen City Council member Adam Frisch starts talking about housing, the first thing he always says is that it's personal and we have to remember that. And I can't help but think of that phrase and that setup when I talk about the APSHA structure discussion that's happened all year round. I started reporting on this early 2018, but led all the way to a blowout from the assistant city manager, Barry Crook, to the point where he is now leaving. I mean, it's just, housing is such an intense discussion. So this is two big stories of 2018 that I'm bringing up simultaneously. One, that we might see an independent housing authority within Aspen and Pickens County, or at least a different way of structuring it, and that it led all the way to the assistant city manager resigning.
It's such a multifaceted, kind of complicated issue. Like, what does APSHA do? Why are we arguing about it? But the reality is it's this independent sort of child organization of Aspen and Pickens County government that's supposed to, you know, manage the affordable housing system, which, as we all know, you kind of live and die by in this community. And so that's probably why, you know, as Adam says, it's so personal, especially more so these days. You know, there's almost no free market place to live in Aspen that normal working people can live in.
There is not. Being a normal working person who was looking.
It's been 20 years.
So it gives tremendous power to this, what's really just an administrative agency. So there's constant arguments over how that power is wielded or who gets control, and it just gets very, very complicated. And once again, sort of bubbling frustration for years boiled over. And we have Adam Frisch, a longtime city councilman who's now running for mayor, calling for a re-examine this thing and see if there's a new way to structure it. They basically want elected officials to sit on the housing board to give the decisions a little more weight sometimes than they have now. And the issue is that the city has all this money for housing that, it's always complicated how that gets spent.
So that the city has its own collection for housing. The county doesn't, but they have 50-50 split.
Right, and APSHA doesn't control the city's, housing development arm. And that's what you saw with the assistant city manager. The city is trying to do this huge project, three projects. They've hired a private developer to come in and build and manage once they're built. And what happened, that APSHA doesn't really have a role in that necessarily, except for just managing the people who live there, making sure they qualify.
Right.
And to that point of the compliance officer getting on board this year, too. I think that's another big part of APSHA, that people who live in the housing feel like, okay, finally we have a voice, and, where do we go to explain to somebody they haven't lived there for 3 months, and there's a new person coming in, the short-term rental issues or, the tax returns or anything like that. And I think that act in itself will help people who use the units feel a little bit more like, okay, people are paying attention to this. So now let's look at the other issues of, do we have one person in a 3-bedroom and the retiree? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, there are so many arms to this housing authority.
What I think the compliance officer, the best thing that could happen there is that she shows almost everyone's in compliance and we just need more housing, you know? Right. John, you had a comment.
I think, first of all, when you see something that's this complex, you got to figure out, how did it become so complex? Because back in the 70s, it was, hey, let's try this thing. And nobody's ever done it. We don't really know how it's going to work, but we'll make it work. And I think the original complexity is that you have the city of Aspen and Picken County, which are they're two different cultures, and they have two different missions, really. And so expecting them to work together in something that is so important and contentious and there's so much money involved is a little unreal. And I think Adam's solution of let's create a third entity, and this is why there are nonprofits in the world. Is that something nonprofits do things that more efficiently than a government can do them, but that the private sector won't do. And this is a perfect example of that. And so probably eventually maybe this should become a nonprofit that is funded by the county and the city and has a board of directors that includes the stakeholders, including HOAs and the people who are actually buying into it, but it include the county and the city. And I think that's kind of the direction that's it's probably grown to that size, that APSHA has played its role and now it's time to
revamp it.
Yeah.
Well, I do think if we have any successful housing program that we're looking back, 40 years from now, we'll say in 2018, they started having those genuine discussions. So you've been listening to the Roundup show, the Valley Roundup year-long Roundup show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Very happy holidays to all of you. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Can't wait for new 2019 news. I'm Allison Bechtesh. I'm in the studio with Curtis Wackerly, who is the editor of the Aspen Daily News, David Krause, the editor of the Aspen Times, and John Masters, the executive director of Grassroots TV. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News. Thank you all so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.